Everyone has that one goal, that thing they want to prove. Not to other people, but to themselves. Then, right when you think you could actually do it, cancer. And that goal is still within reach. I would know. I'm about to run my first ever marathon with my two best friends. 3 years after having cancer.
At least we look good in these shorts.
Woo! Let's get it, guys. You, keep making plans.
Visit ohiohealth.com/keepmakingplans to learn more.
Welcome back to Feminist Book Club, the podcast. We're not just about feminist books. We are here for social justice, literature, and media in all its forms. But we do that through an intersectional feminist lens. Thanks for being here. Let's get started.
Greetings, friends. I'm Marijita Guerrera, and we're talking today with Ruth Ozeki about her most recent novel, The Book of Form and Emptiness, published on Tuesday, September 21st. Ruth Ozeki is a novelist, filmmaker, and Zen Buddhist priest, as well as the award-winning author of three other novels, My Year of Meats, All Over Creation, and A Tale for the Time Being, which was a finalist for the 2013 Booker Prize. Her nonfiction work includes a memoir, The Face, A Time Code, and the documentary film, Halving the Bones. She is affiliated with the Everyday Zen Foundation and teaches creative writing at Smith College, where she is the Grace Jarko Ross 1933 Professor of Humanities. Welcome, Ruth. It is an honor to be speaking with you. Thank you for taking the time.
Yeah, thank you so much. It's lovely to be here.
So this book, the book within this book, discusses the role of readers in interpreting the meaning and direction of a book for themselves. And you say, according to the capabilities of the reader, books have their own destinies. This is such a dynamic book. And I feel like I could read it dozens of times and have dozens of different experiences each time. But what struck me overwhelmingly on this read was how very Buddhist the book is.
How fundamentally
Buddhist it feels to me anyway, starting even with the title of the book as one of the more recognizable lines of the Heart Sutra.
That's right. Exactly. Yeah.
So you're a Zen Buddhist priest. I assume this is not accidental or subconscious.
it's not accidental. Although, I mean, that's a great comment. It's not accidental, but it's not entirely intentional either, in the sense that I never set out to kind of write a Buddhist book or to put Buddhist ideas in the book or, you know, anything like that. It's more just that, you know, it's kind of who I am at this point. I've been practicing Buddhism for long enough that it seems like, you know, Buddhism is just my life, right? And so any kind of creative expression, I think, would in some way reflect, you know, the Buddhist values and the Buddhist, the practice itself. So it's a great question, you know, to think about.
Yeah, I really appreciated it, because I feel like it's the kind of book that you can read if you have that history and that foundation. Mm-hmm. You can pull that from the book. Mm-hmm, but if that's mm-hmm. not something that you have a great familiarity with, the book itself is still a phenomenal work. You know,
you
still get so much from it. Yeah. It just shifts a little bit your perspective, perhaps, on it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, it's funny, because I don't think Buddhism is anything special in a way. It's just a way of looking at reality the way it is, you know, and so in that sense, it doesn't rely on a whole kind of doctrinal apparatus in order to, you know, to make sense of it. It's very common sense, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. My understanding of Buddhism is not especially complex. I went to a Buddhist university. And so I got a lot of background from that and was surrounded by a lot of phenomenal human beings. And I've done some reading for myself and self-education and things of that nature.
That's great.
But I haven't delved in to such a significant degree that I would probably get all of the pieces of it, but it was enough that it felt like a comforting blanket or something that surrounds the events in the book, because the events in the book can be really challenging.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Well, as in life, there is darkness too. And we have to somehow equip ourselves to, you know, to deal with that. Right. And
yeah.
I mean, that seems to be the big challenge for all of us. Right.
Yeah. I did want to say, this isn't a question either, but the story that you relayed about the broken teacup, I first read that a similar story about the broken goblet. I believe it was a Thai Buddhist monk that is ascribed to have been telling that story first about how already broken. And that work was so pivotal for me in understanding and embracing impermanence and the beauty of the now, that I just really loved that it was in this book.
Oh, nice.
I really liked it. So thank you.
Yeah, sure. Thank you for recognizing it.
Yeah, yeah. Benny, in the main character, the main young man in this book, has lost his father and arguably has also lost his mother at the same time to her own grief. He's on the cusp of puberty, which seems arrested a little bit by the trauma that he's gone through, which we know can happen. And as a result of this great loss, he starts manifesting characteristics of severe mental health issues. What prompted you to write about such a challenging and often underrepresented childhood experience?
Yeah, well, you know, I think the idea of, in particular, voice hearing, which is what, you know, what Benny experiences, was something that, you know, after my own father's death, and I wasn't a child then, I was an adult, but after my own father's death, for about a year or so after his death, I occasionally would hear him calling my name. And it was always when I was doing something completely random, like, you know, folding the laundry or, you know, doing the dishes or something like that. And I would hear sort of behind me, I would hear him clear his throat and then say my name, Ruth, you know. And every time this happened, I would just, you know, whip around, you know, expecting to see him, because, you know, in that moment you forget, And it was so familiar. And so I would whip around. And of course, there'd be nobody there. And so every time this happened again, I would experience that feeling of loss and grief. And, you know, it would sort of, I'd revisit that, And this happened, I don't know, maybe a half a dozen times or so during the year. Again, maybe it was about a year after he died. The experiences were so brief, It was just this brief little moment of hearing this outside my head, and I didn't really pay that much attention to it. There was a lot of other things going on, and I just thought, I just must have heard something, or, I didn't really pay attention to it. And then as a fiction writer, as an artist and a fiction writer, when I'm writing a book, characters come to me as voices. I hear the voice of a character speaking to me, And I remember I was talking about this at a library in, I think it was in Michigan, and a member of the audience, a man, raised his hand and he asked me, when I'm talking about hearing voices, hearing the voice of a character speaking to me, he asked me, are you hearing that voice as if it's outside your head, or is it more like you're hearing it with your mind, And so I answered and I said, well, in the case of characters, it's more like I'm hearing it inside my head, but I have had this experience of hearing a voice outside my head as well. And so we had a conversation about this, and it turns out that this man's son heard voices, and the voices that he heard, again, as if with his ear, as if outside his head, were very disturbing to him. So this was a very disturbing experience. And that's really what got me thinking about this spectrum of experience that we call hearing voices, And you often hear, artists talking about, and creative people talking about hearing, hearing a voice of, like I'm saying, a character speaking to you, or musicians hearing music in their head, And I started thinking about this spectrum that exists kind of between creativity on one hand and what we call madness on the other hand, And creativity is an exalted state, it's celebrated in our culture, and madness is a problematic state, in our culture. It strikes me that what we call normal is actually very, very small, And since there are so many instances of people hearing voices in so many different ways, what would happen if we expanded that slightly? What would happen if we, we questioned, what is it that we pathologize, And so I think that the book really, this idea of sort of pathologizing and, what happens when certainly a child is marked as having a mental illness, diagnosed and medicated, what does that do to the child, in terms of, the child's sense of who they are. Right. Mm-hmm. And again, you know, I just add one last thing is that, you know, when I was a teenager too, I have always struggled with depression. And when I was a teenager, I also ended up in a, you know, psychiatric ward. And, you know, it was a locked ward and it was a very shocking and very traumatic and probably, now that I think about it, completely unnecessary experience, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And so once again, you know, that was something that I, you know, I gave that experience to Benny in the book in order to kind of explore what exactly that meant to be a child pathologized like that.
You approach the topic with such sensitivity and caring in from so many different perspectives that at the beginning of the book, at least for me, it wasn't crystal clear whether or not this was a negative thing or a mental health mm-hmm, issue, mm-hmm. especially because there's some magical realism mm-hmm. in the book that as a reader, it takes a little while for you to sort of ascertain whether or not this is a problem really, mm-hmm. or if it's just mm-hmm. a facet of the world, which I think was a really lovely way to approach it because you don't automatically go in stigmatizing Benny. You know.
Exactly. And I think that's the problem is that in our sort of medicalized culture where mental illness is treated as a kind of an equivalent to physical illness, when in fact, I don't believe it is. Once you're given a diagnosis, right? And certainly once you're, you know, you're medicated for that, it is stigmatizing, right? And I just thought, well, you know, what happens if the line there is kind of blurred, right? Which I think probably it is. What would happen then to this child and to the conversation, you know, around these kinds of conditions, right? These unshared experiences.
And he struggles so in the book to make himself understood, you know, and mm-hmm. tries to yeah. walk that line between what do I share and what do I not share?
Right.
I think was
right.
done,
right.
you know, very, yeah. Very expertly yeah. and with yeah. a lot of compassion.
Yeah, thank you. Well, you know, and I think the other thing too, I mean, is that we all, you know, we all hear harsh voices, right? Mm-hmm. Whether we hear them with our ear as if it's outside us, or we hear them with our mind, you know, inside us. I think we all, by the time we're teenagers, have internalized all of the crippling, harsh, critical voices, and they stay with us. You know, they are very, very powerful. And so with Benny, he happens to hear them with his ear as if it's outside. But I certainly, as a writer, you know, I know that, you know, that I have a multitude of those, you know, critical voices, you know, the inner judge, the inner editor, you know, the inner critic. And those voices are always trying to mess with me. You know?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. In an interview for A Tale for the Time Being, you talked about your reluctance to enter yourself into that story. Mm-hmm. And you ultimately became a pretty significant component of the story and provided mm-hmm. a really good balance to the other side of Now's experience. I noticed that you snuck yourself into this story too.
Yeah, right.
Explicitly to watch over Benny.
Yes, that's right. That's a very good point. I hadn't even really thought about that. Yes, there's a character in the Book of Form and Emptiness who hangs out at the library, and she's the typing lady,
yeah.
right? And she sits at the library in a carrel, you know, a desk next to near Benny's, and she just kind of keeps an eye on him. And occasionally they talk a little bit. And you know, when Benny's mother Annabelle comes to the library to check up on him, you know, she has a short conversation with Annabelle. You know, in order to kind of reassure her. I wasn't sure whether readers would really pick up on that, but I'm glad you did, because it was like a little, the book is kind of metafictional, you know, it's narrated by a talking book. It's basically a book that's narrating itself into being, right? The book is having a conversation with its protagonist. And it seemed to me that the author should be, you know, the so-called author should be somewhere in the mix. And so yeah. that's where she ended up.
Yeah, I liked that your character in the book did watch over him, but didn't interfere really,
yeah,
you know,
yeah, yeah.
And I think teenagers, especially, that's kind of the sort of guardianship they need a lot of the time. It's not an adult, you know, micromanaging their
yeah,
lives,
yeah,
but just being there.
That's right. And I think that's exactly the kind of attention that fictional characters need too,
mm-hmm.
because if you start trying to micromanage them, you get yourself into all sorts of trouble. You know, you really have to let your characters have their lives. And, you know, as the writer, I feel like I'm following as best I can, you know, trying to keep up with the character. But once I start, you know, once I start getting too bossy, you know, and having too many kind of smart ideas and starting, you know, I start trying to impose all my clever, smart ideas onto the characters, it just doesn't work. You know, yeah. something goes dead. I mean, just like a teenager, right? That, you know, oh, they absolutely. Go blank, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It's the same out. Relationship. Yeah, it's exactly the same relationship.
I had a question for you about crows. So they've been an important symbol across cultures and through time. A Japanese crow featured in A Tale for the Time Being. Yep. Crows were very important in this book. Yeah. I was just wondering if that is tied to the Buddhist tradition of crows being messengers for you, mm-hmm. or if there was another reason behind that. I really liked it.
Yeah. You know, I think there's probably a lot. I mean, certainly the idea of, you know, the crow being a messenger is, I think, you know, certainly part of it. Crows being a kind of, well, ravens, I suppose, but being a kind of harbinger of death. But also it's just, it's kind of simpler than that in that I am just fascinated by crows. I'm fascinated by their intelligence. I end up doing a lot of, you know, reading about crows' intelligence. There was a really wonderful, you know, there's a whole series of experiments being done out of the University of Washington, you know, sort of showing the way that crows teach their young. And it's just, it's absolutely fascinating stuff. So it part of it is just, you know, I tend to allow whatever it is that I'm obsessed with in my life, I tend to allow that stuff to kind of move into the books, right? Mm-hmm. And inform the books. And I think I do that because it's a way of introducing slightly random elements into the book, right? Allowing the book to kind of take a different course if it wants to. And in this case, that's kind of what happened. The crows, you know, I happened to be reading about crows, and then suddenly the crows were, you know, flying into the book, and yeah. they were doing things, right? They were behaving in interesting ways. So
that's fascinating.
Yeah. That's kind of how that happened.
Wonderful. I was wondering if it was just a fondness for Corviday, or if there was, you know, there doesn't have to be a big significance behind these things. They can just be because they want to be.
Exactly. You know, and I kind of just, yeah, like I said, you know, I just kind of allow things that enter my life to, you know, sort of move into my fictional worlds as well. In fact, in this book, it was almost a game I played. I just kind of made a rule that if somebody gave me something interesting, or if I overheard something in the street, a little snippet of conversation, or if I read an interesting article or book, I would just kind of allow it to, you know, I'd put it in the book, I'd put it in the manuscript, right, mm-hmm. in the draft, and see what happened, right? And again, it's kind of a way of, yeah, just introducing random factors. And so, for example, in this book, there's a whole kind of symbolic motif around snow globes, right? Mm-hmm. And that was just because my editor went on vacation and came back and gave me a snow globe. You know, which I gave to Annabelle. I gave to, because Annabelle, Benny's mother, is kind of a collector, right? She loves to collect stuff, right? And so it was just, oh yeah, this is exactly what Annabelle would collect, right? So I gave it to her. And then that, of course, spawned a whole, you know, a whole lot of other images and little episodes in the book. It actually became kind of a motif throughout the book. It's fun to kind of play a little bit like that.
Yeah. Is that how Jorge Luis Borges, the olive, ended up in there?
Yes. You know, I also love Borges. And I think there was Borges in A Tale for the Time Being, too, if I'm not mistaken. Can't remember. I think there was.
It's been a little while.
There was some Borgesian. Yeah, I think there was some Borgesian stuff that snuck in there. But, you know, since so much of this book is set in a library, and Borges was so obsessed with libraries, it seemed like really important that he be a player in this book. And not him so much, but his characters, his fictional characters. And I really felt, you know, too, that the Book of Form and Emptiness is being narrated by the Book of Form and Emptiness, right? It's being narrated by a book. And I really do think that books talk to each other. The way I like to kind of imagine it anyway is there's a kind of rhizomatic network, you know, that connects all books to each other. And so it seemed to make sense to me, some kind of demented sense that, you know, that my book would be talking to, you know, to Borges somehow, to Borges's books. Yeah.
There were a lot of different books in here, sort of like a little literary Matryoshka doll. And that was lovely, created a lovely texture.
Yeah.
We're about out of time. I wanted to ask you one more question. Mm-hmm. Is Annabelle a hungry ghost?
Oh, interesting. That's a great question. I don't think she is somehow. Annabelle, she's a woman who has lost the love of her life, right? And so she's heartbroken and she's been traumatized by that. She also is a woman who, she's very creative and she sees, she has a very intense relationship, as does Benny, right, with the material world. And, you know, she loves to craft, she loves to make things, right? And so when she sees objects, she sees things in the world, what she sees is their potential, you know, their promise. Matter to her is very vibrant. It's almost alive, right? As it is with Benny. So it's something that the two of them share. Mm-hmm. So I think it's slightly different than the notion of the Buddhist notion of hungry ghost, which is somebody who wants something so badly and can never be satiated, right? Mm-hmm. The iconography is of a person, you know, a kind of human figure with a tiny little thread-like neck and throat and a big bloated belly, right? And I don't see Annabelle as being like that. I think she's just a very kind of loving and generous and creative person who sees potential, sees promise in everything, right? Yeah. And she gets very excited by the world, perhaps too excited, you could argue. You know? But yeah.
In my heart, when Benny gets older, she and he can bond over their connection to the world in this way. So
I think that's exactly what starts to happen at the end of the book, you know, that they start to understand that, you know, the ways in which they are similar and the ways that they can help each other.
Thank you so much for spending this time with us. This was an incredible book. I'm so grateful to have read it. Is there anywhere folks can find you online? Anything that you want to bring up?
Sure. Well, you know, going my website, I'm really happy with my website these days. I have a beautiful website and it's www.ruthozeki.com. And Twitter links and Facebook links, I think, are all up there. And Ozeki Land is the, you know, the handle I go by on Twitter and Facebook. So
wonderful. Well, we'll put all of that in the show notes as
Excellent.
Well. Again, I'm Mariquita Guerrera. You can find me on Instagram at @O_Murray. That's MURRAY. Thank you, Ruth, so much. I appreciate you taking the time.
Thank you. Thanks so much for a wonderful conversation.
Thank you for tuning in to today's episode of Feminist Book Club, the podcast. Want to be part of the club? Here's how you can join us. Obviously, subscribe to our podcast and leave a rating and review for brownie points. Follow along on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, Pinterest, and TikTok. All of those links are in the show notes. Sign up for our newsletter to be the first to know what our next monthly book pick is. And check out our award-winning monthly book subscription service. Oprah Magazine named it one of their favorite book boxes, and Shonda Rhimes called us one of her favorite subscription boxes in general. There are multiple membership levels for any budget, and it's an excellent way to support the show and the voices you heard today. See you in the club.
A well-read woman is a dangerous creature.